Coming up next, it's the food show, including various topics and guests, especially Lisa Migrant, who is from, she's the culinary director at Raven and Rose, talking about using the whole plant in cooking. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Also by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. And now we're going to get right to the food show.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, because you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food, working those lands for corporations.
Welcome to the Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel.
And I'm Rachel Bennett.
Today on the...
And I'm Rachel Bennett.
Today on the Food Show, we have four guests. We'll be talking with Lisa Migrant, the owner and culinary director at Raven & Rose, about using the whole plant in recipes. We'll also hear from Liz Crane, who recently released the second edition of her book, The Food Lover's Guide to Portland.
And we'll also be talking to Chantal Cabrera, Vancouver-based herbalist, talking about ancient herbal wisdom meeting the modern kitchen.
But first, I want to take you on a bit of a bread adventure. I talked with Sam Fromarts, a writer slash amateur baker who recently wrote the book, The Search for the Perfect Loaf, A Home Baker's Odyssey. We talked about some of the places he visited writing the book, discovering new bakeries, and what it takes to make really good bread. Here's that interview with Sam Fromarts, recorded in the studio here at KBOO. So at the beginning of the book and at the beginning of your bread journey, it seems like a pretty common story from these last few years. So talk about how losing work propelled you into the quest that ultimately resulted in the book, you know, The Search for the Perfect Loaf.
Right. Well, in 2008, I was a freelance journalist and I was doing freelance editing as well. And as you know, Lehman Brothers imploded in the fall in October. And in December, shortly before Christmas, I got a call from two editors on the same day, actually, telling me that they had to cut back and they wouldn't be needing my services anymore. And so roughly three quarters of my income evaporated in the course of one day. So not an unusual story at that time, right? So I started emailing around friends. I've been a journalist for a long time. I have a lot of friends in the business, to find out if they had any work. And one friend emailed me back, and she was the founding editor of this magazine called Afar, which was doing experiential travel, which is like, you know, really experiencing the culture rather than just going visiting tourist sites. And she said, you know, we're starting out. Do you have any ideas? And I kind of blurted out on the spur of the moment, well, I've always wanted to go to Paris to work in a boulangerie to see if I could perfect the baguette. And at this point, I had been baking for, you know, about, you know, over 10 years. And baking a baguette at home had eluded me. And so I made more sourdough breads, more whole grain breads. But it was like this kind of, you know, it was really frustrating that I wasn't able to do this one loaf at home. And so the story itself became this quest to learn the techniques that I could then translate into the home and make this loaf. But I think just that timing was really important because it was the recession. Nothing was working. And so I figured I would just try and do what I loved, which was baking bread and eventually writing this book. And luckily, it all kind of worked out and things fell into place.
Oh, it seems like the classic, like lemons into lemonade. Although I guess this, in this case, it would be the flour and into yeast bread. Yeah,
totally. So yeah, it was great. And it was interesting because for me, bread baking was always my mode of relaxation. And I actually, you know, although I'd been a journalist for a long time, I'd only wrote about it very rarely. And the reason was I didn't want to make it my work. Like, I didn't want it to become like mixed up with all the stress of my work life, you know, because it was so special to me to keep it like it was. And so, but necessity is the mother of invention. And in this case, you know, it became an opportunity to kind of do something I really wanted to do.
Well, that gets me to a conversation you had with Alice Waters. So in the book, you write about a baking event that was hosted by Alice Waters. And after the event, she pulls you aside, and you mentioned to her that you've interviewed her in the past. She doesn't remember that interview, but she compliments you on the excellent bread that you provided for this dinner. So I'm wondering if you've ever had the thought of, well, should you be baking professionally?
Yeah, actually, in that conversation, Alice said, "Oh, you should open up a wonderful bakery because bread is so special." And, you know, I think for her, and you know, bread is like the next thing after a salad. That's the most wonderful thing to eat. And I just met her by happenstance because I had baked these. I actually had kind of perfected the baguette. It got some attention in Washington and was written about. And then through another chef, she had invited me to bake at this charity dinner at Bob Woodward's house, which was really kind of uncanny because I'd never baked professionally. The most I'd baked was for a Thanksgiving dinner of about 20 people. So this was really my first professional gig, was baking for Alice Waters. Of course, I didn't get paid, but the loaves were really well received. And the funny thing about that is she's always invited me to bake for her charity events in Washington. When I interviewed her as a writer, she never remembered who I was, right? So, but I don't think I love writing and I love baking. And if I were a professional baker, I've worked in bakeries now. I mean, that was kind of the premise of the book, was to learn from professionals. So I've really seen what that life is like. If I was maybe 22, I would do it. It's a really grueling, physically demanding job. And I don't think it's not, I love to bake, but it's one of the many things that I love to do. I wouldn't want to do it, you know, with all of my time.
Well, and we can talk about your home baking practices. You sort of talk about how with the timing of the bread, it sort of becomes embedded in your lifestyle. And I'm wondering how it became embedded in your lifestyle specifically.
Well, the thing about bread making, and actually historically all of grains, is what drives the use of them is kind of necessity. And this is kind of a little tangent, but it relates, which was people ate grains. I mean, they were hunter and gatherers, but they actually started eating grains because they were a great source of stored calories, right? You didn't have to eat it right away. It wouldn't spoil. You could keep it, you know, for several months and then make beer with it, which is probably what they did before they baked. You know, eventually they were baking with it. And, you know, if you are kind of short of food, it's great to have a little store around that you could kind of, you know, depend on. So that's kind of the reason that grains are eaten. In my own life, necessity kind of drove my methods as well, because I found I could mix the dough in the evening, let it rise for a little while, refrigerate it overnight, and then bake anytime, either within the next 24 or even 48 hours, and I turn out with a good loaf. And what happens in that long fermentation period is that flavor really develops. So not only was I getting the benefit of flavor, but I was getting the benefit of a really flexible schedule because I could finish the loaf whenever I had time. And so people don't really know that about baking. It's like, oh, I've got to do the next thing. It's got to rise. And then I got to do this. And then I got to do that. And you actually don't. If you just put the dough in the refrigerator, you take it out and let the dough work on your schedule, you know, not vice versa. So there's a lot of things you can do to make bread work for you, and it becomes, you know, part of your own life and, you know, your own schedule.
The way you describe bread making, it definitely sounds more sensorial than it is intellectual. And I think, you know, when you talk with the bakers and you ask them about technique, oftentimes you get an I don't know, because it's just so ingrained in what they do. And as far as recipes go, it almost seems like that's secondary. So, yeah, I'm wondering, how does one become good at making bread?
Yeah, if you ask a baker, they'll, you know, like, how long do I let it rise? Well, until the fermentation is done. And, you know, how long do I let it bake until the crust is nice and dark, you know? And, you know, that's kind of the recipe. And I say in the book that I think the recipe is about maybe 10% of bread making, you know? And it's because it's all about technique, and technique that you learn by repetition and practice, and technique that you learn by making mistakes. And so I say, when I started out, I made a lot of bad bread following really good recipes. And so you can make really good bread as a beginner, but to really learn the craft, like anything, it kind of takes time. But here's the interesting thing that happened to me, and I think it's something that's kind of lost in our culture, which is my hands, in a sense, really began learning. And so much in our culture is about cognitive skills, you know, which obviously you need, and thinking mind is great. But you can get a lot of knowledge out of your sensations and your tactile feel for things. And it gets to the point where there's this sort of natural process that's happening where your hands are kind of telling your body what to do, which is a very strange sensation for somebody who for most of their adult life has lived in what I call the cognitive mind. Right?
So are you describing something that's like more than muscle memory? It's sort of this like reverse communication?
Yeah, it's muscle memory, but it's also, yeah, your hands, your eyes, your sense of smell are really informing everything that you do. And it's a very unique kind of experience. And here's the thing, when I was looking back at history of baking, like I was reading recipes from, or not recipes, I was reading about the bakers of ancient Rome. And, you know, in like the first or second century, there was, you know, like more than 800 bakeries in Rome. So not one recipe survives from that period, which tells me that the way that they learned or passed on their knowledge was not by recipe, right? It was all by experience. And it's this kind of experiential, tactile learning that I think we've forgotten. Although I want to back up a little bit, because in the recession, when a lot of people couldn't get jobs, and in places like Portland started opening up food carts and doing all these wonderful things because they couldn't do anything else, I think to a degree that's come back, right? People have learned to value those things like, you know, making bread or, you know, fermenting vegetables or whatever it is they do that depend on this kind of more sensory craft knowledge, which is, I think, quite valuable to a culture. But as a culture, I think we've kind of lost it for the most part.
It's not a recipe book.
No, it's not. It's really a narrative, right? Kind of a memoir. And I get into the science of bread making, the history, and also a lot of travels with very weird and wonderful bakers around the world.
But then there are recipes in the book that sort of come at the end of the chapter and sort of kind of cap off your experience.
Right. I tried to use the recipes to elaborate the point I was making in the chapter. So if I'm writing about ancient grains, I actually have a recipe that uses some ancient grains, you know, in this case, in a flatbread. And if I'm writing about sourdough fermentation, which I try and explode a lot of the myths around sourdough, I have a recipe for making sourdough that follows not too distantly from a method described by Pliny the Elder from ancient Rome.
The recipes themselves are, I mean, there's, you know, you give the ingredients, you list that, but they are then multi-pages usually. So a lot of it is the description.
Right. I try and really describe the technique of making the loaf, because it's not simply mix the ingredients, knead until the gluten's developed, because I'm trying to describe what you're looking for when gluten is developing. I use a method also that doesn't use kneading. It's more like a stretching and folding technique. One that actually Ken Forkish, another Portland baker, describes in his book, Flour, Water, Salt, and Yeast. And he describes it quite well. And I'm not, as I say, it's not a recipe book, but I try and kind of describe the technique enough so that people can give it a whirl.
So I want to talk about the future of artisan bread making. It seems like the trend in contemporary bread making is sort of rediscovering lost practices, rediscovering ingredients. What is the future of baking bread, and is the innovation in reclaiming the past?
I think the innovation actually will continue to be in reclaiming the past, and mainly for this reason. So in the past, farmers grew a lot of diverse types of grains. And the reason that they did that was they always wanted to hedge their bets. If the wheat failed, the barley might make it. You know, if the barley failed, the rye might make it. You know, if all of those failed, you might still have buckwheat. And so as a result, in the pre-modern era, there were all of these, a great variety of loaves made with all of these grains. And the bakers, who were often the same as the farmers, right? They were baking in village ovens. Would know how to manipulate all these grains to make a decent loaf of bread. Now we don't need to do that, because there's like a very uniform, steady supply of wheat, and we can, you know, have as much white bread or now more whole wheat, you know, that we want. But there's all these diverse grains that really went by the wayside. And as a result, I think our diet itself became, especially with grains, became much more of a monoculture. So I think what bakers, the most exciting bakers, are bringing back this diversity of grains and trying to figure out how to work with them so that they become loaves that people want. And I actually surprise people when I say I don't prefer 100% whole wheat loaf, even though it's like, you know, whole grains are the best for you. Obviously, you want that fiber and all the nutrition that's in the bran and the germ. But 100% whole wheat, I feel, doesn't really have as great a taste as when you blend whole wheat with other grains. And so I mix rye with whole wheat, or I make a rye buckwheat whole wheat, which is just mixing these other grains in there just adds this really wonderful taste. So I think we should kind of try and get beyond the wheat, you know, and look at these other grains, barley and things like this. Or I often make oatmeal and put it in the bread, or polenta and put it in the bread. You know, there's so many things you can do. I had a loaf at Little Tea American Baker yesterday that was a potato loaf, then, and on the outside of the loaf they put crumbled potato chips, which made this really crunchy, crackly crust. It's not whole grains or anything. You just want to eat it in small amounts, which we did with like a charcuterie plate, which was wonderful. But it was just a very innovative bread, and that's the kind of innovation I think that we need need more of. I think Kim Boyce is also doing it, you know, in Portland with her bake shop, and she's using a lot of diverse grains. And I just had her figgy buckwheat scone today, which was really wonderful.
Well, you said it in the beginning of the book, how the like pragmatic you would have said when you were pitching the story going somewhere in the United States, and you included Portland, and I was really excited by that. And then, but somehow you blurted out Paris.
Right. So, well, I'd thought about traveling around the U.S. just for my own, you know, to visit a baker, to learn skills on my own, not to write about it. And I always imagined, yeah, Portland or San Francisco or Vermont. But this was an international travel magazine, so the location obviously became Paris very quickly, and I was glad that I did that. And I subsequently, you know, as I said, went to the south of France, and I worked with a baker there, you know, growing his own ancient wheat. And I also went to Berlin to work in a bakery where they ground their own flour, and they were a biodynamic bakery, kind of an offshoot of organic. And they ground their own flour the day they made the breads, and they were 100% whole grain. And the reason I wanted to go to Germany was because whole grains in Germany, whole grain breads are just bread, right? It's, you're not eating it because it has a label in it that says whole grains. You're not eating it because it says 6 grams of fiber in every slice. You're eating it because it's good bread, and it's understood that way. And I just wanted to see a place where whole grains were really a part of the culture and try and learn to make those breads, which I think I did. So it was really a nice development for me as well.
You traveled a lot in the process of writing this book. And so I want to go back to the title of the book, In Search of the Perfect Loaf, and ask you, did you find the perfect loaf?
I didn't. And I was with this baker, Jim Leahy, in New York's at Sullivan Street Bakery, another great baker. And he said, you know, the perfect loaf doesn't exist. And I would have to agree. And that's kind of what makes baking so wonderful, or any craft work, really, right? I mean, there's the Japanese potters who would make like a perfect bowl and then make a mark in it, right? So it was imperfect. You don't really need to do that with bread, because you can always see something that you might improve. But I got to say, some days you do get really pretty close, and that's really exciting. And you try and figure out what you've done right, and maybe it was the weather, maybe it was, who knows what it was, but all everything sort of lined up in it, and it came close to that perfect loaf. And then the next day you'll bake again and it'll be a little off.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. That was an interview with Sam Frohmartz, author of The Perfect Loaf, A Home Baker's Odyssey, which is now available for purchase.
Next, we'll be speaking with Chanchal Cabrera, a Vancouver-based herbalist with a specialty helping people manage cancer. She's been a member of the UK-based National Institute of Medical Herbalists since 1987, and later obtained her MSc in Herbal Medicine at the University of Wales. Chanchal also holds a faculty chair in botanical medicine at the Borcher Institute of Naturopathic Medicine in New Westminster. She serves on the board of advisors of Dominion Herbal College in Barnaby, and the editorial board of Medical Herbalism Clinical Newsletter. She's also a certified master gardener and horticulture therapist. Chanchal, welcome to The Food Show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Tomorrow evening, you'll be speaking in Portland at the Herbal Apothecary, presenting Ancient Herbal Wisdom Meets the Modern Kitchen. Will you tell us about the class you'll be teaching and what inspired you to share this knowledge?
Mm-hmm. I'm very excited about this class. It actually blends two of my great passions, herbal medicine and food. And I think what I really want to talk about in the class, and what I really want to share with the audience, is how much medicine there is in the kitchen already. And it's not even about going out and buying special foods, but really just what you already have. So we're going to do some very practical examination of things that the average kitchen will have, like honey and vinegar and oatmeal, really sort of fairly standard things. And then, of course, some of the herbs and spices that a lot of people have in their kitchen already. So things like cinnamon and ginger and, of course, oregano and sage and some of the more Mediterranean-type herbs. So we're going to look at using them both in food context as medicine, so actually eating your medicine. But we're also going to talk a little bit about using them in a slightly more clinical context. So, for example, we'll explore some of the chemistry behind rosemary and why Shakespeare wrote about it for the memory, and how that's been proven in modern science to be valid and very useful in a clinical practice. So we're going to try and blend a little bit of the science with a lot of very practical things that you can do at home.
What is one of your favorite kitchen herbs, and what medicinal properties does it hold?
I kind of guessed you might ask me that. I think, you know, there's a game I like to play, which is sometimes if I was washed up on a desert island, you know, what three bits of music would I have? That's, of course, based on an old English radio station show, Desert Island Discs, where, you know, celebrities would decide on their music they had to have on their desert island. So I like to play that, but I also like to do it with books. What three books would I have to have if I could only have three for the rest of my life? And then, of course, what herbs and what foods? And because I'm always trying to get, you know, good value for money, I'm starting to think about, well, what food is also a medicine? And so my number one most favorite that I couldn't manage my clinic or my kitchen without is going to actually be garlic. And, you know, it's familiar to everybody, but I'm willing to bet there's not enough appreciation of garlic. Most people don't eat garlic as a vegetable. They have it as a condiment on the side. But that's because they haven't been to my house where we eat garlic as a vegetable. But it's also, of course, a great medicine. It's great for cholesterol management. It's great for blood sugar management. Most people know that it's good for the immune system. So, and it tastes great. So it sort of crosses all those lines.
So I'm wondering, how much does the preparation affect the sort of medicinal value of the herbs,
or, you know, as you mentioned garlic as an example, how much does the preparation affect the herb?
Yeah, well, it can affect it a great deal. You know, garlic is a good example. If you just hold a clove of garlic in your hand, it doesn't smell particularly strongly of anything, but as soon as you cut it, you start to get that wonderful aroma. And that is because there's a compound in garlic that is activated by exposure to air. So in that case, if you simply took your whole cloves of garlic and put them in your soup or whatever, apart from it being a bit of a shock to bite into, you wouldn't get the amount of medicine that you would get if you were to cut that up and leave it on the side of the counter for 10 minutes before incorporating it into the dish. So in that case, the air, the oxygen, is critically important. But in other cases, in perhaps I could say most other cases, a lot of the flavor and indeed the medicine of some of these culinary herbs and spices is carried in the volatile oil or the essential oil. So things like oregano and rosemary and sage and cinnamon and ginger, those all have their medicine in their essential oil or their volatile oil. And if that is allowed to evaporate, so if you're cooking it with the lid off and the house is smelling wonderful, you're getting less and less in the pan because they're evaporating out into the air. So in that case, preparing your herb with the lid on is really important. So I often suggest to people when they're cooking to, chop the garlic up and set it aside for 10 minutes before putting it in the pan. But once you've put it in the pan, or once you've put your other herbs and spices and what have you into the pan, you want to put the lid on. And then the steam that comes off that's carrying all those flavors and all those medicines, all those volatile components, will condense inside the lid of the pan and drop back into the soup or the stew or whatever it is you're making. So yes, the way you prepare herbs is important. In some cases, you want air on them. In some cases, you want to contain the steam. And I think more than anything, it's important to have good quality herbs to start with. So really fresh, really vibrant color, really good strong smell. You don't want tired old herbs, because you'll get tired old medicine and, I suppose, in the end, tired old people from taking it.
What are one of the more unusual applications of kitchen herbs for medicinal use?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, one of the things I want to talk about tomorrow night in our presentation is actually about potatoes. And, of course, most people eat potatoes on occasion, but most people don't realize what a great medicine it is. And one of the quickest things in the kitchen, if you have a sliver or a splinter or even like a sting, an insect sting that's in you, take a slice of raw potato and tape it over the area just with, you know, bandages, band-aids, whatever, And within about 20 to 30 minutes, the potato will have pulled out any slivers or stings or little splinters that are under your skin. So it's a drawing agent. So I think that's kind of an unusual one because pretty much everybody has potatoes around most of the time. It's very quick and easy. And as you know, it's quite hard to get slivers and splinters out. Sometimes it's poking around at yourself, practically doing surgery with a needle and a scalpel. And you could just put a slice of potato on there and pull the whole thing out painlessly.
Great. Now that fall is approaching, what kitchen herbs are particularly valuable?
Mm-hmm. I think the interesting thing with that question comes back to looking at seasonalities of medicine and seasonalities of food. We do know that our bodies change with the seasons. We have, for example, a higher demand for vitamin D in the winter because we don't get the sunlight, so we're not making it, so we need to make sure that we're eating foods high in vitamin D. So, for example, in my clinic, I'll often have patients eating a lot of oily fish in the winter. But as the summer comes around, I might switch them off some of that fish and eating perhaps some of the oils in the form of something like coconut oil, which is better for the hot climate. So now that the fall is coming, I like to look at what's going on around me. I like to look at what's going on in nature. So what I'm seeing is that the leaves are fading out, that there's less color and less vibrancy in the leaves, but all the roots are getting really settled in for the winter. So the energy of the plant is redirecting from leaf to root. And so that tells me that root foods and root medicines are probably quite useful at this time of year as our, if you like, our global energy and our psychic energy sort of turns in. We start to get a little bit more inward looking and we want to hunker down a little bit with the cold weather coming. So we're starting to talk about things like the carrots and the beets, the root vegetables, and even things like squash. So in terms of medicine, those foods are energetically appropriate for this time of year. They're building, nourishing foods. They're not light, thin, airy foods like salads or the hot days, but they're more grounding and stabilizing for the cold winter. So with that, you want to use your warming, stimulating herbs and spices. So in the summer, you might be using more things like the mints, which are cooling. But in the winter, you want to turn back around to things like ginger and turmeric and cinnamon, and the warmings and black pepper, slightly stimulating herbs that help to pick up the energy a little bit as the seasons change and everything sort of goes down for the winter. We want to keep ourselves still feeling energetic and vibrant. So those warming herbs are quite useful there. And of course, they go well with a lot of the root vegetables as well.
So Chanchal, you live on Vancouver Island and you're growing vegetables and herbs on 7 acres. You're building a healing retreat center as well. Will you share about your plans here?
Yes, what I'm doing on Vancouver Island, my husband and I have a 7-acre, we call it uncertified organic, so we've not gone through all the certification process, but we operate as organic. My husband grows vegetables, so he's running a CSA, a community-supported agriculture. We've got 15 households that buy food from us on a weekly basis. And then I grow the herbs for my clinical practice. I'm not making a lot of tinctures, but I do make all my own tea blends. And also, of course, for teaching, because we are a teaching facility on Vancouver Island, and so we have a fairly large teaching garden where the plants are arranged according to body systems, so the heart, the lungs, the kidneys. And I can use that, as I say, for teaching as well as somewhat for harvesting. So, yeah, we're actually in the process of rebranding now as a botanic garden, which means a garden open to the public that is featuring education. And that's more or less what we do on our little 7-acre slice of paradise.
We've been speaking with Chanchal Cabrera, clinical herbalist. Chanchal, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a great pleasure. I'm very much looking forward to being back in Portland for the weekend.
Yes, again, Chanchelle will be presenting a class tomorrow evening on Ancient Herbal Wisdom Meets the Modern Kitchen. The class will be held at the Herbal Apothecary at 2714 Northeast Alberta from 6:30 to 9. $20 pre-registration, $25 at the door. You can visit the website at kboo.fm/foodshow for a link to the event.
You are listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. We turn now to the subject of creative culinary decisions, namely using as much of the plant as possible when cooking. We are joined by Lisa Migrant, owner and culinary director at Raven and Rose, which is located in the 132-year-old historic Ladd Carriage House in southwest Portland. Lisa, welcome to The Food Show.
Thank you. Hi.
So Raven and Rose recently featured peach leaves on the menu. Could you tell us how they were used?
Yeah, peach leaves are one of my favorite sort of forgotten ingredients. The leaves from the peach tree, when steeped in warm liquid for a very short period of time, give off a very sort of fragrant floral and slightly almondy flavor. So it's a very, it's got a peach flavor in the background, but mostly floral and then almond forward. If you steep them for too long, it gets bitter quite quickly. They were a very common ingredient maybe 100 years ago to flavor things, and they've just kind of been forgotten. We use them in a peach leaf ice cream, and we serve it with a peach tart that's really, really lovely. It's very complimentary to the peach flavor. We also use them in, we make a syrup out of the peach leaves and put them in a peach-flavored cocktail, a peach sangria. It lends a very delicate, lovely sort of almondy flavor in the background of everything. It's very, very popular, actually, and people are always surprised that the flavor comes from the peach leaves.
Well, that was going to be my next question. How were they received by the customers?
Yeah, people love it. People, generally, when they see the ingredient listed as peach leaf ice cream or peach leaf in the ingredient of the drink, they're always asking questions because they didn't even know they were edible, and they have no idea what that's going to taste like. And so it's really kind of fun to surprise people, and we'll let them taste the syrup from the drink directly and bring them out the ice cream, and they're always very pleasantly surprised. Yeah.
So that kind of gets us in. So talking about the peach leaves and using those in your recipes, mm-hmm. That kind of gets us into the conversation of using unconventional plant parts or ingredients that, you know, we don't commonly think of as edible or as useful in the kitchen. So I'm wondering if there are any other unconventional plant parts that you've used in recipes in the past.
Sure, absolutely. And speaking about peaches more, the inside of the peach pit is called a noyau. That's a French word, but we don't have another name for it in English. If you crack open the pit out of the inside of the peach, a little thing that looks like an almond comes out. They also come out of cherry pits, but they're really tiny, apricots and other stone fruit. And it's a little kernel inside the peach pit, and it has a very strong almond flavor, and they're actually called bitter almond. So almond extract and things with even almond milk is flavored with these, and it's a very, very strong almond flavor. And again, if you use too much, it can be bitter. But using them in moderation, you can take these little kernels, toast them, grind them, and then use them in amaretti cookies, things like that. Or you can use them and steep them again and make a liqueur or a syrup to put into beverages. It's a really delicious flavor, and it's kind of like making homemade almond extract. And so that's another forgotten ingredient.
It sounds like you probably don't want to just toast them and eat them as if you're eating an almond.
No, you wouldn't. I mean, it would be a sort of a strong kind of offensive flavor. And I mean, if you ate them in huge quantities, there's a trace amount of arsenic in them. And so, you know, you want to use them in moderation, but they are... They're forgotten, and they're really delicious and lovely. Yeah.
Any other forgotten ingredients?
Absolutely. One of my very, very favorite things to use is the rose geranium, which is a scented geranium, true geranium, just like your garden flower, but the leaves actually give off a rose scent. There's also many other scents that come from scented geraniums, but the rose geranium is what we use. We use that to make... desserts and syrups as well in the bar, and it kind of tastes like rose water, and it gives a really lovely flavor. And you can just grow that in a pot in your house all year round and just pick leaves off, steep it with fruit or in teas or in syrups, and it's really, really lovely. And then there's just lots of different things. We try to use every part of the plant when we can. For instance, beet greens. A lot of times people just use the beetroot, which is what they're used to using, but the greens are really delicious, have a pretty pink tint to them. Turnip leaves, the greens off of a lot of root vegetables are virtually all edible. Carrot greens are also edible, though they're not as delicious as some of the other ones, in my opinion. We also use fava pods. So the pods off of fava beans, you know, you get a giant mountain of waste from shelling favas, and you get little tiny fava beans. But we use the pods, and we actually batter them and deep fry them and serve them with a little dipping sauce. And they're really delicious. They get really tender, and they kind of taste like a green bean, sort of. So that's a nice thing to use. There's lots of other things. Lemons. Lemons are really great. So we use lemons, we juice every day for the bar and for the kitchen, and take the zest off for things. But the lemon shells and the membranes and the seeds in lemons actually contain very high levels of pectin. So you can actually take the lemon shells and boil them in water, and you get an extract from that that you can use to set jams and jellies, and you can even use it sort of as a vegetarian gelatin, which is a really cool thing. And then you use every part of the citrus, which is fun.
Why is it exciting to include unconventional plant parts in your menu?
For a couple of reasons. One is that it's a lot of fun just to sort of surprise people at the restaurant. You know, customers come in and they see things listed on the menu or sitting on their plates, and they had no idea they were edible, and they wonder where that flavor is coming from, or they're just sort of surprised, and they want to have a conversation with the server or with the chef about it. And it's just sort of a lot of fun to see people's worlds expand a little bit and get them excited about trying all sorts of new things. And then the other thing, which is really, really important to us at the restaurant and me and my life, is just reducing waste. You know, it takes a lot of hard work to produce a single vegetable, to take care of any plant or animal for that matter. And just using as much of it as possible and not wasting it is just sort of important to me. So always trying to find new uses and reduce waste is core to our principles.
And it seems like with the peach pit, I mean, you're getting these flavors that you would just not normally find. So this like almondy flavor, which you wouldn't associate with the peach, but now you have it.
Exactly.
And you can use it.
Yeah, it's just a really neat thing. People, there's just flavors that people don't really experience in their lives at all. And they're just sitting there waiting to be discovered. So it's a cool thing to introduce people to new flavors like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Anything else you want to tell us about Raven and Rose?
So this topic is pretty relevant to what we do at Raven and Rose, which is we feature foods from the British Isles. I lived in London for a while, and I went to cooking school in Ireland on a farm. And these are cuisines that most people don't think of as particularly amazing, but they have really world-class food over there. And these are peasant cuisines. These are very simple country cuisines. And because of that, they use all parts of the plant and animal out of necessity, because food is hard to raise and expensive. And they've developed some really, really, really delicious, amazing, simple foods. We're just really excited to be featuring some of those dishes and introducing them to people on this side of the world.
Hey, could you give us a hint at one of those dishes?
Hint at one of those dishes. Well, I mean, for instance, we do our Sunday roast. On Sundays, we feature family-style roast, which is very, very traditional over in that part of the world. Every Sunday, people get together and eat roast meats, Yorkshire pudding, and then lots of vegetable sides. And so we've got an ever-changing array of the chefs go to the farmer's market every Saturday, and then Sunday they produce all these different vegetable sides that are really awesome and use all sorts of parts of the plants that people aren't used to trying. And Yorkshire pudding is one of our signature things that many, many people aren't used to having, or maybe once a year at Christmas kind of type thing. And so that's our favorite. People love Yorkshire pudding.
Right. Sounds exciting.
Yeah.
So we've been talking with Lisa Migrant, owner and culinary director at Raven and Rose in Southwest Porton. Lisa, thank you for being on the Food Show.
Thank you for having me.
So you are listening to the Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. Our next guest has been featured on the Food Show before. She's back with us to share about the second edition of her book, The Food Lover's Guide to Portland. Along with The Food Lover's Guide, Liz Crane recently wrote Toro Bravo, Stories, Recipes, No Bull. She is also the editor and publicity director at Hawthorne Books, located here in Portland, and is a co-organizer of the Portland Fermentation Festival, which is coming up in October. Liz, welcome back to the Food Show.
Thank you so much, Chris. Good to see you.
So let's go back in time and talk about the first edition of the Food Lover's Guide to Portland. What inspired you to write it?
At that point, I'd been freelance food writing for several years in Portland, and I was doing an internship at Hawthorne Books, where I now work as editor and publicity director. And one of my tasks was to go through the slush pile there. And no food titles, all fiction and literary nonfiction mostly, that those were the submissions. And quite honestly, there wasn't a lot of good stuff in there. And I thought, well, why am I not, you know, writing my own book proposal? And Portland could use a kind of exciting food book. We have great food coverage here. So I did that. Just several weeks later, I put together a proposal, and I had a lot of articles that I'd written for the Portland Tribune that I thought I could pull from and do a lot more in-depth interviews and kind of give Portland a food book that wasn't just dry restaurant descriptions, you know, that kind of gives you the do-it-yourself angle and inspires you to go out and forage and hunt and fish and, yeah.
And then what was it that made you decide it was time for the Food Lover's Guide to Portland to get a makeover?
So that first edition came out in 2010. And I should mention, so I now, the first book was published with Sasquatch. This one is published with Hawthorne. So it has a completely different look and feel, a redesign of everything. And I just thought there's so many new businesses that have opened in the past 4 years, and we should get some of those in here. I've, you know, added a lot more profiles of different folks that are really making the food scene here tick. So, yeah, 4 years is a long time in Portland food and drink.
Definitely. Yeah. I'm just thinking about the food carts in particular, how you see them sort of come and go, and then brick and mortars pop up. And
oh, yeah. Yeah, and there was no way I was going to write that chapter. So that chapter I farmed out, thankfully, to Brett Burmeister of Portland Food Carts. He did an excellent job and kind of highlighted his favorite carts and talks a bit about the history of food carts in Portland. And yeah, that was an overwhelming chapter for me because I just don't eat at food carts that often. And I thought, well, why should I write this? Let's get Brett's voice in here. So.
And the book it highlights Portland businesses and Portland restaurants, but then it also has these sort of peripheral passages that are more educational. Talk about why you include that in the book.
Well, I don't want a dry guidebook for Portland food. It's so vibrant, and I wanted it to be a book that's engaging and that inspires you to, you know, go to the Oregon Food Bank and volunteer in their growing garden, go out to Mount Hood and do some foraging and collect some mushrooms. So I write about the Oregon Mycological Society. I just think that I want people to be actively involved in this amazing food system that we have here. So
sure, all encompassing. It's not just the restaurants that
are
the food providers.
I mean, there are restaurant recommendations and I have lists throughout. So it's called go-to spots. So, you know, my favorite noodle spots, go-to noodle spots, go-to spicy food, list of my favorite brunch spots. But that's all it is. It's very personal and biased. And, you know, these just happen to be places that I love. And, you know, I haven't been to the Raven and Rose, and that's so sad because I've wanted to for a long time, and they've been open for a while. So they're not in the book, but they probably should be. I would love it if I went. I know
well,
I would.
Well, yeah. There will hopefully be a third edition.
Yeah, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. Yeah.
Could you highlight one of your favorite new additions to the book?
Yeah, you know, so at Hawthorne, I'm publicity director, and we have a book that's coming out, Karen Carbo's The Diamond Lane, and it's set in the early 90s. So the task for the book launch party for that novel is to, you know, incorporate some kind of 90s thing. So we were thinking, let's get some candy from that era. And there is a candy shop that's downtown that I don't really have a sweet tooth, but I love to take kids there because it's just this retro fun. It's called Rocket Fizz. It's at 5th or 6th and Alder. I don't know. Look it up. It's right in that area. And they have all sorts of super tasty, unique sodas like Celray and different cream sodas and candy from different eras and imported candies and old movie posters. And that's just a really fun. There aren't a lot of spots in my book that are particularly geared to kids. I mean, I guess it's not. Candy is, everyone can enjoy candy. But yeah, that was a fun one to write about.
What was the process of writing this book like?
It was a lot of work. I think so. For the first edition, I had 50 in-depth interviews with folks. So I would go to their business or their farm or their organization and meet with them and, you know, have a full-on few-hour interview, learn, you know, their background and see how they source things and just talk about what they're passionate about. For this edition, I had help from my editorial assistant, Rachel Smith, helped me so much. She did a lot of the legwork in terms of going to, there's so many new chocolate businesses since the book came out in 2010 and now. So she went to some of those and wrote those up. So it was a lot less of the interviewing and more of kind of combing through and making sure that we have the right new locations. And so many books have been published in Portland, food books, since this one came out. So I had to add for Mark Bitterman's For the Meadow, his two new books, and for Ken Forkish of Ken's Artisan Bakery, his James Beard award-winning cookbook. And then I added some profiles. I added, and that was really fun to interview these folks, Eli of Olympic Provisions. He's co-owner and salumist there. Got to ask him some questions about coming up into cured meat and learned that he, that was when he was 18, he did an apprenticeship in Switzerland. And so he's been doing this for a really long time. And then I also, Trudy Tolliver of Portland Farmers Market, I got to interview her for the book. And I learned that she likes to eat butter off of the knife, just straight up. And so, you know, it was fun. Yeah, a lot of interviews, a lot of face to face. That's what makes it interesting to me. I don't want a dry book. I want those details.
So I know you haven't been everywhere and you haven't experienced everything, you know, in food in Portland, but you do have sort of this kind of bird's eye view, and you just list it off. Parts of the food community that are just all sort of not disparate, but that are kind of all over the place. So you see this like food as a whole in Portland. So I'm curious, what do you see as the evolution of food? How is it changing even in just the 4 years since the first edition of the book?
That's a good question. I feel like just the simplest answer is volume, just more of everything. I think a lot more kind of complex procedural food products that are coming out. I mean, chocolate, certainly. There's so many bean-to-bar businesses now. So, you know, when the book came out originally in 2010, I think maybe there were a small handful of folks that weren't just taking chocolate already made and tempering it and forming it into truffles and bars and adding ingredients. Actually making the chocolate from the cacao to the chocolate. So there are a lot more businesses such as that that exist now, and a lot more alcohol in town. So hard cider is just booming right now. And you came to the book launch party that I had at Reverend Nat's, and that was on Labor Day, and Reverend Nat's Hard Cidery. And I think that cider is going to just continue to have a lot of growth, and a lot of new cideries will hopefully be opening up, distilleries, breweries. I mean, breweries was ridiculous. I mean, it's such a small amount that I profile in the book, but there are ones that I love. There are just a lot more of them out there. Yeah.
Now, what a transition. I did mention in the introduction that you're the co-organizer of the Portland Fermentation Festival. Could you talk a little bit about that event?
Sure. So first off, this year's is on Thursday, October 16th, from 6 to 9:30 at EcoTrust. It's the fifth annual festival this year. I co-organize it with my friends David Barber and George Winborn. And actually, later today, I would just love to say that People's Food Co-op is having their Harvest Festival today, and George and David and I are doing fermentation demos to promote the festival at 2 and at 4:45. But so the Fermentation Festival is a unique event in that most of the people that are presenting their foods and sampling their foods are folks that are not doing these ferments professionally. They're just doing them at home. So you can go and try everything from miso to cheese to cured meats that people make just because they're passionate about it and they want to share it with others. So we really stress that this is a no sales event. So you can't make any purchases once you're inside, and you are there to skill share and talk to people and learn about food fermentation. This year we have a panel of experts that will kick off the first hour of the festival. So David Barber of Pickleopolis, also the co-organizer, will be talking. Eric Finley of CHOP, Josh Gerges of Commons Brewery, and oh my goodness, there's one other person. Oh, Nat West of Reverend Nat's Hard Cider. So that'll be fun. We have demos so you can, you know, go out onto the mezzanine and learn how to make all sorts of interesting cheeses from Claudia Lucero, or learn how to make natto, which is pretty funky. And you can learn how to make that from Heidi Nessler. Oh, yeah. It's always a fun, stinky time.
How did you originally get involved in the Fermentation Festival?
So George, David, and I are just great friends, and I think that George and David met Sandor Katz, who wrote Wild Fermentation and who kicked off the initial festival with us and came back last year. He did a fermentation workshop of sorts out at Tryon, and I think that that's where George and David met, and then George and I met a couple years later, maybe a year later. He was having a kraut party at his house. So a bunch of people come together and bring, this time of year, bring a bunch of vegetables from the garden, and everyone chops and salts and makes these ferments together. And anyhow, we're all just very passionate about this. We do this on our own. I make all sorts of wines at home, and hard cider and miso and krauts. And I love the experimentation of it, and I love the full flavors of fermented foods. And some people enjoy fermented foods mostly for the healthy aspect. I don't really enjoy anything for the healthy aspect. I just really love making it. It's curiouser and curiouser, and I learn a lot, and I love how it tastes. Yeah.
And I'm sure every year you learn something new at the Fermentation Festival.
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah.
So give us one more time the details about that, the date and, you know, ticket info and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. So tickets will go on sale at the end of the month. We have a website, portlandfermentationfestival.com. We are doing online ticket sales. So there's two different tiers of tickets. You can go to the panel and the tasting, one of the tastings. And it is Thursday, October 16th. From 6 to 9:30 p.m. at EcoTrust in the Pearl. EcoTrust has hosted the festival from day one. And so you can come and, you know, ask a bunch of awesome questions of all of these folks about, you know, what cured meat and cider and what have you for the first hour. Or you can just come to the tasting, one of the other two tastings, and try all of these foods from people who are just geeking out and making awesome things at home. Yeah.
We've been talking with Liz Crane, author of The Food Lover's Guide to Portland. Liz, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Show.
Thank you guys so much. It was really fun.
That's all the time we have for this episode of The Food Show. I'd like to thank our guests, Sam Frobarts, Chanchal Cabrera, Lisa Migrant, and Liz Crane. If you missed any part of the show or want more information about the guests, you can visit The Food Show page on the KBOO website. I'd also like to thank our amazing board operator, Tammy. Stay tuned in to KBOO. Jazz Lives is coming up next. We'll be back with more food-related radio in October. The Food Show airs the third Wednesday of every month at 11 a.m. Until then, I'm Chris Siegel.
And I'm Rachel Bennett.
Thanks for listening.
sort of that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do harm.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Northwest Connector, connecting riders to the Oregon coast through daily round-trip bus routes from Portland, Salem, and Corvallis. Northwest Connector buses are equipped with bike racks and offer 3-day and 7-day passes with transfers up and down the coast. Schedules and trip planner at nwconnector.net. And that's it for public affairs programming this morning on KBOO, your community radio. It's your radio station. Where Jazz is up next, Jazz Liz with Nick is going to immediately follow the KBOO Noon News headline. Stay tuned for that.
Oh, it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, September 17, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson.
In local news, the unemployment rate in Oregon is on the rise again, even though more people are getting jobs. The problem is that the increase in jobs is not keeping pace with the increase in population in the state. According to a report from the State Employment Department, the current unemployment rate in Oregon is 7%.
NASA may award a contract to Boeing for a transport mission to the International Space Station, according to a Wall Street Journal article Tuesday. This marks the latest contract to be awarded to the private sector for space travel, with the California-based SpaceX taking the lead in NASA contracts. Since President Obama took office, the area of space travel has been privatized to a large extent. Charles Borden, NASA's chief, must still approve the decision to award the contract to Boeing.
In national news, on Tuesday, the Senate blocked a final vote on the Paycheck Fairness Act for the second time this year. This legislation, if passed, would strengthen the Equal Pay Act of 1963 and would prevent retaliation against workers who ask about their employer's pay practices or inquire about their own wages. This legislation is central to guaranteeing equal pay for women.
The Army Chief of Staff told reporters yesterday that airstrikes against